Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. When I think of con artists, the first names that pop into my head are Frank Abagnale, Charles Ponzi, and Lord Gordon Gordon. No relation, by the way. At least I hope not. But the history of confidence artists includes several devious, diabolical women who have swindled, grifted, and scammed their way to acquiring ill-gotten gains, like Elizabeth Holmes and Anna Delvey. Tori Telfer is here to tell us about many more. She's the author of Confident Women, Swindlers, Grifters, and Shapeshifters of the Feminine Persuasion. Tori tells us why she had wanted to write a book about female con artists.
Well, I had written a book about female serial killers, so I was sick of that. So I was looking around for other types of female criminals and, you know, seeing which ones sort of sparked my imagination and looking at some female bandits. But when I found female con artists, I don't know, it was just so obviously right. And I couldn't believe that no one had really written about them comprehensively before when there's so many of them, more than serial killers, I think.
What are the differences between the kinds of cons that con women pull and the kinds of cons that con men pull?
I think the main difference is that con women and con men use gender stereotypes for their cons, to their advantage. So they have no interest in like dismantling systems, you know. The con women are going to lean into being a sobbing young mother or a sad elderly widow or, you know, whatever stereotype of femininity others might want to avoid. The con woman is like, I'm going to use that because it's going to work to my advantage because people will be more willing to believe me. Whereas con men, you know, might be like, I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge or trust me, I'm a doctor.
Yeah. You say that the fact that we like con artists so much is probably the greatest con of all time. What do you mean?
What I mean by that is that everyone in my book, every con artist that we know has had a run-in with the law, has probably done some serious prison time. And yet, they're like folk heroes to us. You know, we applaud them. We think they're great. We make movies about them. Leonardo DiCaprio plays them in movies. And it's just like the con artist population has swindled us all so thoroughly that we applaud them when they are still criminals. You know, they're still committing crimes that get them in trouble with the law, just like robbers and drug dealers.
Why do you think that we often find ourselves admiring con artists?
I think it's a couple reasons. They're very clever. They have to be. The cons often involve backstories and aliases. And these things are fun, of course. I mean, how many movies and books involve secret identities and double lives? But I think another major reason is we don't think that they do really bad things. We don't think that, you know, they often don't physically harm anyone. They mostly don't ever kill anyone, although there is a woman in my book who does. So I think that we feel comfortable cheering for them because we're like, okay, so she swindled some people out of money, but it's not like she killed anyone. And that is part of the con because actually the victims in my book are extremely broken and traumatized from their run-ins with con artists. But just aesthetically, it like looks better to us, society.
Yeah. And I think it's probably also that we say like the victims of the con artists, we tend to say, oh, how stupid they were to fall for that. It's their own fault. I would never fall for something like that. One of the reasons you say that we admire the con woman is that we secretly want to be her. Why?
Yes. I mean, some disagree with me, but I think that me, for example, tried to sneak into a party once. I'm still traumatized by getting caught. It was so embarrassing. I just don't have the nerve. I don't have the stomach for that sort of thing. So when I see these con women just waltzing into parties, there's a woman in my book who crashed a bunch of parties in DC, including a party by the vice president at the time. There is a part of me that's like, wow, the nerve and the bravery and the courage it would take to pull something like that off. It's kind of enviable, you know, just to really not care what others think, not care what the law says.
Yeah, plus you're self-employed, depending on certain cases you have someone you answer to, but generally it seems that con women and con men are working for themselves, so there's clock to punch, yeah. If you don't mind my asking, is there a con woman you'd most want to be, if you were going to be one?
I might be, oh, this is a hard question. I might be Margaret Lydia Burton, who was a sort of con woman on the run in the 1950s. She just went from city to city in the U.S. and would change her name at each city, and her daughter would change her name too, and she would get some sort of fabulous house with a pool, swindle a couple $1,000s from her employers, and then leave in a getaway car. And she did end up getting caught after driving a pink getaway car out of town with a ton of expensive show dogs in a moving van behind her. She did get caught, but she didn't spend that long in prison. And I just think she had a lot of fun, like, running away from the law and getting away with it so many times.
Yeah. Of all the con women you profiled, is there one in particular that left the biggest impression on you?
I maybe thought the most about Rose Marks because she's one of the few in this book that is still alive. And I spoke to her son, her sons, actually. I interviewed the detective who tracked her down. So I never talked to her, but I guess I was just closer to her. Her con is one that a lot of people, like you mentioned how we mock the victims, and her victims. So she was a fortune teller who swindled her victims, who defrauded her victims. Fortune telling is not illegal, but fraud is. Mm-hmm. And with crazy stories of, you know, oh, I can't give you your money back because it burned in the World Trade Center attack. Michael the Archangel has your money. You're going to be reincarnated and marry Brad Pitt. You know, tales that sound so silly, but when you dig into like how she did it and how convincing she was and how manipulative she was and how vulnerable her victims were, it starts to make sense.
Yeah, let's talk about one con woman that really left an impression on me, my fellow Canadian, Cassie Chadwick. Can you tell us a bit about Cassie?
Yes, sure. Cassie was, what a gal. So she was from a small town in Canada, came down to Cleveland, Ohio to make her marks, plural. And she started off with minor scams, you know, swindling a bit of money for a fake health scare here, telling people she had died over here. Spent some time in the penitentiary in Ohio. Married a wealthy dentist. This was not a scam. He seemed to really love her and seemed to be just a really great guy. And he was like, Cassie, my darling, spend my money. And she spent so much of his money. She bought all of her friends a grand piano. For a Christmas present for him, she completely redid their entire house. Like every single piece of furniture, every rug, every painting she replaced. Which is a little bit stressful, I think.
Yeah, I'd say. What would you consider to be Cassie's most successful con?
Well, I think it was post-marriage. Well, she was still married to this guy. And finally, she was genuinely rich. So she didn't have to con anymore, but she couldn't stop. And so eventually, she claimed to be the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie, who was possibly the richest man in the world at the time. And it was genius because no one could question her because, you know, you wouldn't just go up to Mr. Carnegie and ask him if he'd had an affair. Like, it just wasn't done. So she lived this life as his illegitimate daughter. And she swindled bankers saying, like, look, he's given me a trust for $11 million. Could I take out a loan? Like, you know, I'm good for it. I'm Andrew Carnegie's daughter. It was very successful. She kept it going for quite some time, but she just pushed it too far and conned too many people, and of course, like, it was inevitable that one of them would crack and go to the police and or the media, and that's how she got caught.
Yeah. Her name became synonymous with future con women, right? Mm-hmm. Cons started to be called Cassie, so she made quite an impact.
I think she was, like, the original, you know, everyone's obsessed with Anna Delvey now, and we've all forgotten about Cassie Chadwick, but she was, like, the OG Anna Delvey times 100, you know. She became sort of the metaphor, the godmother of all of it.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Cassie Chadwick's eyes a great deal. What made her eyes so striking and effective?
So people said that she had hypnotic powers. I mean, people were very convinced. And what I think was going on was she herself was incredibly persuasive. And you might even feel dizzy if you talk to her for long enough. But she was not the most gorgeous woman, not the youngest woman. So people were kind of like, how is she managing to swindle all these men? And they kept landing on her eyes. Now, I've only seen, you know, sort of unflattering black and white portraits of her. So I personally can't speak to her eyes, but enough people talked about them, including a Canadian journalist who visited her in jail, that I buy it. Like, she just had something in her gaze that was really effective.
Yeah, so that makes me think maybe it's time for Kim Carnes to record Cassie Chadwick Eyes. What do you think?
I would play that all the time on Spotify.
Yeah. You write about a group of female con artists that you describe as tragedians. What is a tragedian?
I came up with the term, but I did not come up with the type of con. And they're not necessarily female, but these are women who use a real tragedy to con people. So they will say that they lost their house in Hurricane Katrina, or they were there on 9/11. Any tragedy. I'm sure they're doing it right now with the pandemic, you know? And really almost every tragedy in human history that we know of, there have been these types of cons. The con artist looks around, sees that everyone else is being really generous and is giving a lot of money to the victims. And they're just like, I'm a victim too. And everyone's emotions are running high. It feels callous to fact check them and be like, are you really a victim? And so these cons are very effective and very, very common.
Which tragedian in the group of women that you profiled stood out to you as the most galling, the most audacious?
It would have to be Tanya Head, who was a 9/11 faker, the most famous of the fakers, probably, although there have been a couple. She wasn't even in the U.S. on the day the World Trade Centers came down, but she just seemed to be obsessed with the attention that being a survivor, quote unquote, would bring, even though, of course, the real survivors weren't reveling in the attention. But she came to the U.S. and weaseled her way into this survivor organization and became like an advocate for them. She actually did some really positive things for them. And she had this incredible story of being right there when the second plane came through the window and her arm coming unattached from her body. And she sprinkled in, it was an outrageous story, but she sprinkled in enough real details of things that really happened so that it made her story work for quite some time until a journalist decided to do a profile of her. And he was like, why won't you tell me your husband's name? Why are you breaking down in tears? And I asked, and the whole thing unraveled.
You have this great section at the end of your book where you discuss how the con woman weaponizes confidence itself, both meanings of the word. Can you tell us about this?
Sure. So we think of confidence as like, I'm really feeling myself today. And that's one meaning. But there's an older meaning, a rarer meaning, I guess, which is like, I'm taking you into my confidence. And the con woman uses both of those things. She takes you into her confidence, partially using the fact that she is so confident. She then destroys your confidence in yourself after you figure out that you've been conned. So it's like this tangle of all the meanings of the word are used and damaged by her.
That's a great passage, and it's very true. That's very well thought out on your part. I'm curious, has writing this book, researching and writing, because there'd be tons of research involved, has it made you suspicious about other people, especially other women?
No, I think it's made me realize how probably gullible I am. I'd like to think now I could never be conned because I'm an expert, but I think a tragedian could get me any day. Like I said about feeling guilty about the one time I tried to crash a party, I'm just, even after this book, I'm not going to be grilling people I'm not going to be asking to see ID and second guessing them. It feels wrong to do.
Do you have an all-time favorite true crime book?
Yes, I'll tell you the true crime book I wish I could write the new version. The one I want to write and have it compared to is Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Do you know that book? I need to Google. Who's the author?
John, three names, and it's set in New Orleans, isn't it?
I'm Googling it. It's set in Savannah, Georgia.
Oh, Savannah. Yeah, darn. That was in my head, and then I changed.
Yes. Yeah, John Berendt. It's so good. What I love about it is there's a crime, there's a murder in it that's twisty and turny and weird, but there's all these other odd characters, and like Savannah itself is kind of a character, and I'm calling it characters because you wouldn't even think it could possibly be nonfiction, but it is. That's like my dream book.
Thank you so much, Tori Telfer. It was really great to talk to you.
Thank you. This is so fun.
Tori Telfer is the author of Confident Women, Swindlers, Grifters, and Shapeshifters of the Feminine Persuasion. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Andrew McCarthy, Zakiya Dalila-Harris, and Tori Telfer. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to our esteemed colleague, Tom Blaine.
Blaine? His name is Blaine? Oh, that's a major appliance. That's not a name.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You know, deep down inside, I really think they liked me.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I like to give everybody one chance to screw up.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Me? Oh, you know, it ain't easy being me.